No, not with these few. Then it matters not whether Druss's arrival was coincidence or otherwise. We may hold for a few more days because of his training, but that is not enough. Morale is high, old horse, so best not repeat those sentiments. Do you think me a fool? I will stand and die with Druss when the time comes, as will the other men. I share my thoughts with you because you will understand them. You are a realist, and moreover, you remain only until the third wall falls. With you I can be frank, surely. Druss held Skeln Pass when all others said it would fall, said Bowman. For 11 days, not 3 months, and he was 15 years younger then. I don't belittle what he did. He is worthy of his legends. Knights of Druss Delnok. Have you ever seen such knights? Farmers, peasants, and raw recruits? Only the Legion have seen real action, and they are trained for hit-and-run charges from horseback. We could fold on the first attack. But we won't, will we? Said Bowman, laughing. We are Druss's knights, and the ingredients of a new legend. His laughter sang out, rich and full of good humour. Knights of Druss Delnok, you and me, Hogan. They will sing about us in days to come. Good old Bowman, he came to the aid of an ailing fortress for love of liberty, freedom, and chivalry. And gold. Don't forget the gold, said Hogan. A minor point, old horse. Let us not ruin the spirit of the thing. Of course not. I do apologize. However, surely you have to die heroically before you can be immortalized in song and saga. A moot point, admitted Bowman, but I am sure I will find a way round it. Above them, on Mursif, Wall 2, several young culls were ordered to help fetch buckets for the tower well. Grumbling, they left the battlements to join the line of soldiers waiting by the stores. Each armed with 4 wooden buckets, the men filed from the building towards the shallow cave beyond where the Mursif well nestled in the cold shadows. Attaching the buckets to a complicated system of pulleys, they lowered them slowly towards the dark water below. "How long is it since this has been used?" asked one soldier as the first bucket reappeared, covered in cobwebs. "Probably about 10 years," answered the officer, Dungata. "The people who had homes here used the centre well. A child died in here once, and the well was polluted for over 3 months. That and the rats kept most people away." "Did they ever get the body out?" asked the cull. "Not as I heard. But don't worry, lad. It's only bones by now and won't affect the taste. Go on, try some." "Funnily enough, I don't feel very thirsty." Garter laughed and dipped his hands into the bucket, lifting the water to his mouth. "Spiced with rat droppings and garnished with dead spiders," he said. "Are you sure you won't have some?" The men grinned, but none stepped forward. "All right, the fun's over," said Garter. "The pulleys are working, the buckets are ready, and I should say the job's done. So let's lock the gate and get back to work." Garter awoke in the night, pain ripping at him like an angry rat trapped in his belly. As he rolled from the bed and struggled to rise, his groaning woke the other 3 men sharing the room. One of them rushed to his side. "What is it, Garter?" he said, turning the writhing man onto his back. Garter drew up his knees, his face purple. His hand snaked out, grabbing the other's shirt. "The water! Water!" He started to choke. "He wants water!" yelled the man supporting him. Garter shook his head. Suddenly his back arched as pain seared him. "Great gods! He's dead," said his companion, as Garter slumped in his arms. Chapter 19 Rek, Serbitar, Virai, and Vintar sat around a small campfire an hour before dawn. The camp had been made late the night before in a secluded hollow on the south side of a wooded hill. "Time is short," said Vintar. "The horses are exhausted, and it is at least a 5-hour ride to the fortress. We might get there before the water is issued, and we might not. Indeed, it may already be too late. But we do have one other choice." "Well, what is it?" said Rek. "It must be your decision, Rek. None other can make it." "Just tell me, Abbot. I'm too tired to think." Vintar exchanged glances with the albino. "We can, the 30 can, join forces and seek to pierce the barrier around the fortress. Then try it, said Rick. Where is the problem? It will take all our powers and may not succeed. If it does not, we will not have the strength to ride on. Indeed, even if we do succeed, we will need to rest for most of the day. Do you think you can pierce the barrier? Said Virai. I do not know. We can only try. Think what happened when Serbitar tried, said Rek. You could all be hurled into the... whatever. What then? We die, answered Serbitar softly. And you say it is my choice? Yes, answered Vinta. For the rule of the 30 is a simple one. We have pledged our service to the master of Delnog. You are that master. Rek was silent for several minutes, his weary brain numbed by the weight of the decision. He found himself thinking of so many other worries in his life, which at the time had seemed momentous. There had never been a choice like this. His mind clouded with fatigue, and he could not concentrate. Do it, he said. Break the barrier. Pushing himself to his feet, he walked away from the fire, ashamed that such an order should be forced from him at a time when he could not think clearly. Virai joined him, her arm circling his waist. I'm sorry, she said. For what? For what I said when you told me about the letter. It doesn't matter. Why should you think well of me? Because you are a man, and you act like one, she said. Now it's your turn. My turn? To apologize, you dolt. You struck me. He pulled her to him, lifting her from her feet, and kissed her. That wasn't an apology, she said, and you scratched my face with your stubble. If I apologize, will you let me do it again? Strike me, you mean? No. Kiss you. Back at the hollow, the 30 formed a circle around the fire, removing their swords and plunging them into the ground at their feet. The communion began, their minds flowing, streaming into Vintar. He welcomed each by name in the halls of his subconscious. And merged. The combined power rocked him, and he struggled to retain the memory of himself. He soared like a ghostly giant, a new being of incredible power. The tiny thing that was Vintar clung on inside the new colossus, forcing down the combined essence of 29 personalities. Now there was only one. It called itself Temple, and was born under the Delnok stars. Temple reared high under the clouds, stretching ethereal arms across the Delnok crags. He soared, exultant, new eyes drinking in the sights of the universe. Laughter welled within him. Vintar reeled at the center, driving himself deeper into the core. At last, Temple became aware of the abbot, more as a tiny thought niggling at the edge of his new reality. Dros Delnok, west. Temple flew west, high over the crags. Beneath him the fortress lay silent, grey and ghostly in the moonlight. He sank towards it and sensed the barrier. Barrier? To him? He struck at it, and was hurled into the night, angry and hurt. His eyes blazed, and he knew fury. The barrier had touched him with pain. Again and again Temple launched himself towards the dross, striking blows of fearful power. The barrier trembled and changed. Temple drew back, confused, watching. The barrier drew in on itself like swirling mist, reforming. Then it darkened into a thick plume, blacker than the night. Arms emerged, legs formed, and a horned head grew with 7 slanted red eyes. Temple had learned much during his few minutes of life. Joy, freedom, and knowledge of life had come first. Then pain and fury. Now he knew fear, and gained the knowledge of evil. His enemy flew at him, curving black talons slashing the sky. Temple met him head-on, curling his arms around its back. Sharp teeth tore at his face, talons ripping his shoulders. His own huge fists locked together at the creature's spine, drawing it in upon itself. Below on Mursif, Wall 2, 3,000 men took up their positions. Despite all arguments, Druss had refused to surrender Wall 1 without a fight, and waited there with 6,000 men. Orin had raged at him that such action was stupidity. The width of the wall made for an impossible task. Druss was obstinate, even when Hogan backed Orin. "Trust me," Druss urged them, but he lacked the words to convince them. He tried to explain that the men needed a small victory on the first day in order to hone that final edge to their morale.
"But the risk, Druss," said Orin, "we could lose on the first day. Can't you see that?"
"You are the Garn," snarled Druss then. "You can overrule me if you wish."
"But I will not, Druss. I will stand beside you on Eldebar."
"And I," said Hogan.
"You will see that I am right," said Druss. "I promise you."
Both men nodded, smiling to mask their despair. Now the duty culls were queuing by the wells, gathering the water buckets and making their way along the battlements, stepping over the legs and bodies of men still sleeping. On Wall 1, Druss dipped a copper dish into a bucket and drank deeply. He wasn't sure that the Nadir would attack today. His instincts told him Ulrich would allow another full day of murderous tension, the sight of his army preparing for battle, draining the defenders of courage and sapping them of hope. Even so, Druss had little choice. The move was Ulrich's. The Draenei would have to wait. Above them, Temple suffered the fury of the beast, his shoulders and back shredded, his strength fading. The horned creature was also weakening. Death faced them both. Temple did not want to die, not after such a short, bittersweet taste of life. He wanted to see at close hand all those things he had glimpsed from afar, the coloured lights of expanding stars, the silence at the centre of distant suns. His grip tightened. There would be no joy in the lights, no thrill amid the silence if this thing was left alive behind him. Suddenly the creature screamed, a high, terrible sound, eerie and chilling. Its back snapped, and it faded like mist. Semi-conscious within Temple's soul, Vintar cried out. Temple looked down, watching the men, tiny, frail creatures, preparing to break their fast with dark bread and water. Vintar cried out again, and Temple's brow furrowed. He pointed his finger at the wall. Men began to scream, hurling water cups and buckets from the Mursif battlements. In each vessel, black worms wriggled and swam. Now more men surged to their feet, milling and shouting. "What the devil's happening up there?" said Druss, as the noise flowed down to him. He glanced down at the Nadir and saw that men were streaming back from the siege engines towards the tent city.
"I don't know what's going on," said Druss, "but even the Nadir are leaving. I'm going back to Mursif."
In the city of tents, Ulrich was no less angry as he shouldered his way through to the wide tent of Nostakhan. His mind was icy calm as he confronted the sentry outside. The news was spreading through the army like a steppe gorse fire. As dawn broke, the tents of Nostakhan's 60 acolytes had been filled with soul-searing screams. Guards had rushed in to find men writhing, broken-backed on the dirt floors, their bodies bent like overstrung bows. Ulrich knew that Nostakhan had marshalled his followers, drawing on their combined power to thwart the White Templars, but he had never truly understood the appalling dangers.
"Well?" he asked the sentry.
"Nostakhan is alive," the man told him. Ulrich lifted the flap and stepped into the stench of Nostakhan's home. The old man lay on a narrow pallet bed, his face grey with exhaustion, his skin bathed in sweat. Ulrich pulled up a stool and sat beside him.
"My acolytes," whispered Nostakhan.
"All dead."
"They were too strong
Ulrich, said the old man, I have failed you.
Men have failed me before, said Ulrich. It matters not.
It matters to me,
shouted the shaman, wincing as the effort stretched his back.
Pride, said Ulrich, you have lost nothing. You have merely been beaten by a stronger enemy. It will avail them little, for my army will still take the dross. They cannot hold. Rest yourself, and take no risks, shaman. I order it.
I will obey.
I know that. I do not wish you to die. Will they come for you?
No. The White Templars are filled with no sense of honor. If I rest, they will leave me be.
Then rest, and when you are strong, we will make them pay for your hurt. Nastakhan grinned.
Aye.
Far to the south, Temple soared towards the stars. Vintar could not stop him and fought to stay calm as Temple's panic washed over him, seeking to dislodge him. With the death of the enemy, Vintar had tried to summon the 30 from within the new mind of the Colossus. In that moment, Temple looked inside himself and discovered Vintar. Vintar had tried to explain his presence and the need for Temple to relinquish his individuality. Temple absorbed the truth and fled from it like a comet seeking the heavens. The abbot again tried to summon Serbitar, seeking the niche in which he had placed him in the halls of his subconscious. The spark of life that was the albino blossomed under the abbot's probing, and Temple shuddered, feeling as if part of himself had been cut free. He slowed in his flight.
"Why are you doing this to me?" he asked Vintar. "Because I must. I will die. No, you will live in all of us. Why must you kill me?" "I am truly sorry," said Vintar gently.
With Serbitar's aid, he sought Arbedark and Menahem. Temple shrank, and Vintar closed his heart with grief to the overwhelming despair. The four warriors summoned the other members of the 30, and with heavy hearts returned to the hollows. Rek hurried across to Vintar as the abbot opened his eyes and moved.
"Were you in time?"
he asked.
"Yes," muttered Vintar wearily. "Let me rest now."
It was an hour short of dusk when Rek, Virai, and the 30 rode under the great portcullis gate set beneath the Delnok keep. Their horses were weary, lather-covered, and wet-flanked. Men rushed to greet Virai, soldiers doffing helms and citizens asking for news from Drenan. Rek stayed in the background until they were inside the keep. A young officer escorted the 30 to the barracks, while Rek and Virai made their way to the topmost rooms. Rek was exhausted. Stripping off his clothes, he bathed himself with cold water and then shaved, removing the four-day stubble and cursing as the keen razor, a gift from Horeb, nicked his skin. He shook most of the dust from his garments and dressed once more. Virai had gone to her own rooms, and he had no idea where these were. Strapping on his sword belt, he made his way back to the main hall, stopping twice to ask servants the way. Once there, he sat alone, gazing at the marble statues of ancient heroes. He felt lost, insignificant, and overpowered. As soon as they had arrived, they heard the news that the Nadir horde was before the walls. There was a tangible air of panic among the townsfolk, and they had seen refugees leaving by the score with carts piled high, a long, sorrowful convoy heading south. Rek was unsure whether tiredness or hunger was predominant in him at the moment. He heaved himself to his feet, swayed slightly, then cursed loudly. Near the door was a full-length oval mirror. As he stood before it, the man who stared back at him appeared tall, broad-shouldered, and powerful. His grey-blue eyes were purposeful, his chin strong, his body lean. The blue cape, though travel-worn, still hung well, and the thigh-length doeskin boots gave him the look of a cavalry officer. As Rek gazed at the Earl of Dros Delnok, he saw himself as others would see him.
They were not to know of his inner doubts, and would see only the image he had created. So be it. He left the hall and stopped the first soldier he met to ask him where Druss was to be found. Wall 1, the soldier said, and he described the location of the postern gates. The tall young earl set out for Eldebar as the sun sank. Going through the town, he stopped to buy a small loaf of honey cake, which he ate as he walked. It was growing darker as he reached the postern gate of Wall 2, but a sentry showed him the way through, and at last he entered the killing ground behind Wall 1. Clouds obscured the moon, and he almost fell into the fire pit that stretched across the pass. A young soldier hailed him and showed him the first wooden bridge across it.
"One of the bowmen's archers, are you?"
asked the soldier, not recognizing the tall stranger.
"No. Where is Druss?"
"I have no idea. He could be on the battlements, or you might try the mess hall. Messenger, are you?"
"No. Which is the mess hall?"
"See the lights over there? That's a hospital. Past there is the storeroom. Keep walking until you hit the smell of the latrines, then turn right. You can't miss it."
"Thank you. It's no trouble. Recruit, are you?"
"Yes," said Rec. "Something like that."
"Well, I'd better come with you. There's no need." "Yes, there is," said the man, and Rec felt something sharp in the small of his back. "This is a Ventrian dagger, and I suggest you just walk along with me for a short way."
"What's the point of all this?"
"First, someone tried to kill Druss the other day, and second, I don't know you," said the man. "So walk on, and we will find him together."
The two men moved on towards the mess hall. Now that they were closer, they could hear the sounds from the buildings ahead. A sentry hailed them from the battlements. The soldier answered, then asked for Druss.
"He's on the wall, near the gate tower," came the answer.
"This way," said the soldier, and Rec climbed the short steps to the battlement walls. Then he stopped dead. On the plain, thousands of torches and small fires illuminated the Nadir army. Siege towers straddled the pass like wooden giants from mountain wall to mountain wall. The whole valley was lit as far as the eye could see. It was like a view of the second level of hell itself.
"Not a pretty sight, is it?" said the soldier.
"I don't think it will look any better by daylight," said Rec.
"You are not wrong," agreed the other. "Let's move."
Ahead of them, Druss was seated on the battlements, talking to a small group of soldiers. He was telling a wonderfully embroidered tall story which Rec had heard before. The punchline evoked the desired effect, and the night silence was broken by the sound of laughter. Druss laughed heartily with the men, then noticed the newcomers. He turned and studied the tall man in the blue cape.
"Well?"
he asked the soldier.
"He was looking for you, Captain, so I brought him along."
"To be more precise," said Rec, "he thought I might be an assassin, hence the dagger behind me."
Druss raised an eyebrow.
"Well, are you an assassin?"
"Not recently. Can we talk?"
"We appear to be doing just that."
"Privately?"
"You start talking, and I will decide how private it is to be," said Druss.
"My name is Regnak. I have just arrived with warriors from the Temple of the 30, and Virai, the daughter of Delna."
"We will talk privately," decided Druss.
The men wandered away out of earshot.
"So speak," said Druss,
his cold grey eyes fixed on Rec's face.
Rec seated himself on the battlement wall and stared out over the glowing valley. "A little on the large side, isn't it?"
"Scare you, does it?"
"To the soles of my boots. However, you're obviously in no mood to make this an easy meeting, so I will simply spell out my position. For better or worse, I am the Earl. I'm not a fool, nor yet a general, though often the two are synonymous. As yet, I will make no changes. But bear this in mind, I will take a back seat to no man when decisions are needed."
"You think that bedding an Earl's daughter gives you that right?" asked Druss.
"You know it does. But that's not the point. I have fought before, and my understanding of strategy is as sound as any here. Added to that, I have the 30, and their knowledge is second to none. But even more important, if I have to die at this forsaken place,
It will not be as a bystander. I shall control my own fate.
You seek to take a lot on yourself, laddie?
No more than I can handle.
Do you really believe that?
No, said Rec, frankly.
I didn't think you did, said Druss with a grin. What the hell made you come here?
I think fate has a sense of humour.
She always had in my day. But you look like a sensible young fellow. You should have taken the girl to Lentria and set up home there.
Druss, nobody takes Virai anywhere she does not want to go. She has been reared on war and talk of war. She can cite all your legends and the facts behind every campaign you ever fought. She's an Amazon, and this is where she wants to be.
How did you meet?
Rec told him about the ride from Drenan, through Skultik, the death of Reynard, the Temple of the 30, the shipboard wedding, and the battle with the Setuli. The old man listened to the straightforward story without comment. And here we are, concluded Rec.
So you're Bearsark, said Druss.
I didn't say that, retorted Rec.
But you did, laddie, by not saying it. It doesn't matter. I have fought beside many such. I'm only surprised the Setuli let you go. They're not known for being an honourable race.
I think their leader, Joachim, is an exception. Listen, Druss, I would be obliged if you could keep quiet about the Bearsark side.
Druss laughed. Don't be a fool, boy. How long do you think it will stay a secret once the Nadir are on the walls? You stick by me, and I will see that you don't swat anyone from our side.
That's good of you. But I think you could be a little more hospitable. I'm as dry as a vulture's armpit.
There is no doubt, said Druss, that talking works up more of a thirst than fighting. Come on, we will find Hogun and Orin. This is the last night before the battle, so it calls for a party.
Chapter 20. As the dawn sky lightened on the morning of the third day, the first realities of apocalypse hammered home on the walls of Drostelnok. Hundreds of ballistae arms were pulled back by thousands of sweating warriors. Muscles bunching and knotting, the Nadir drew back the giant arms until the wicker baskets at their heads were almost horizontal. Each basket was loaded with a block of jagged granite. The defenders watched in frozen horror as a Nadir captain raised his arm. The arm swept down and the air became filled with a deadly rain that crashed and thundered amidst and around the defenders. The battlements shook as the boulders fell. By the gate tower, three men were smashed to oblivion as a section of crenellated battlement exploded under the impact of one huge rock. Along the wall, men cowered, hurling themselves flat, hands over their heads. The noise was frightening. The silence that followed was terrifying. For as the first thunderous assault ceased, and soldiers raised their heads to gaze below, it was only to see the same process being casually repeated. Back and further back went the massive wooden arms. Up went the captain's hand, down it went, and the rain of death bore down. Rec, Druss, and Serbitar stood above the gate tower, enduring the first horror of war along with the men. Rec had refused to allow the old warrior to stand alone, though Orin had warned that for both leaders to stand together was lunacy. Druss had laughed.
You and the Lady Virai shall watch from the second wall, my friend, and you will see that no Nadir pebble can lay me low.
Virai, furious, had insisted that she be allowed to wait on the first wall with the others, but Rec had summarily refused. An argument was swiftly ended by Druss.
Obey your husband, woman, he thundered.
Rec had winced at that, closing his eyes against the expected outburst. Strangely, Virai had merely nodded and retired to Musif, Wall 2, to stand beside Hogun and Orin. Now Rec crouched by Druss and gazed left and right along the wall. Swords and spears in hand, the men of Drostelnok waited grimly for the deadly storm to cease. During the second reloading, Druss ordered half the men back to stand beneath the second wall out of range of the catapults. There they joined Bowman's archers. For 3 hours the assault continued, pulverizing sections of the wall,
butchering men and obliterating one overhanging tower, which collapsed under the titanic impact and crumbled slowly into the valley below. Most of the men leapt to safety, and only four were carried screaming over the edge to be broken on the rocks below. Stretcher-bearers braved the barrage to carry wounded men back to the Eldebar Field Hospital. Several rocks had hit the building, but it was solidly built, and so far none had broken through. Bob Ritan, black-bearded and powerful, raced alongside the bearers with sword in hand, urging them on.
"Gods, that's bravery," said Rek, nudging Drass and pointing.
Drass nodded, noting Rek's obvious pride at the man's courage. Rek's heart went out to Britan as the man ignored the lethal storm. At least 50 men had been stretchered away, fewer than Drass had feared. He raised himself to stare over the battlements.
"Soon," he said, "they are massing behind the siege towers."
A boulder crashed through the wall 10 paces away from him, scattering men like sand in the wind. Miraculously, only one failed to rise, the rest rejoining their comrades. Drass raised his arm to signal Orin. A trumpet sounded, and Bowman and the rest of the men surged forward. Each archer carried 5 quivers of 20 arrows as they raced across the open ground, over the fire gully bridges, and on towards the battlements. With a roar of hate, almost tangible to the defenders, the Nadir swept towards the wall in a vast black mass, a dark tide set to sweep the dross before it. Thousands of the barbarians began to haul the huge siege towers forward, while others ran with ladders and ropes. The plain before the walls seemed alive as the Nadir poured forward, screaming their battle cries. Breathless and panting, Bowman arrived to stand beside Drass, Rek, and Servitar. The outlaws spread out along the wall.
"Shoot when you're ready," said Drass.
The green-clad outlaw swept a slender hand through his blonde hair and grinned.
"We can hardly miss," he said, "but it will be like spitting into a storm."
"Every little helps," said the axeman.
Bowman strung his yew bow and notched an arrow. To the left and right of him, the move was repeated 1,000 times. Bowman sighted on a leading warrior and released the string, the shaft slashing the air to slice and hammer through the man's leather jerkin. As he stumbled and fell, a ragged cheer went up along the wall. 1,000 arrows followed, then 1,000, and another. Many Nadir warriors carried shields, but many did not. Hundreds fell as the arrows struck, tripping the men behind. But still the black mass kept coming, trampling the wounded and dead beneath them. Armed with his Vagrian bow, Rek loosed shaft after shaft into the horde, his lack of skill an irrelevant factor since, as Bowman had said, one could hardly miss. The arrows were a barbed mockery of the clumsy ballistae attack so recently used against them, but it was taking a heavier toll. The Nadir were close enough now for individual faces to be seen. Rough-looking men, thought Rek, but tough and hardy, raised to war and blood. Many of them lacked armor, others wore mail shirts, but most were clad in black breastplates of lacquered leather and wood. Their screaming battle cries were almost bestial. No words could be heard, only their hate could be felt. Like the angry scream of some vast, inchoate monster, thought Rek, as the familiar sensation of fear gripped his belly. Servitar raised his helm visor and leaned over the battlements, ignoring the few arrows that flashed up and by him.
"The ladder men have reached the walls," he said softly.
Drass turned to Rek.
"The last time I stood beside an Earl of Drass Delnog in battle, we carved a legend," he said.
"The odd thing about sagas," offered Rek, "is that they very rarely mention dry mouths and full bladders."
A grappling hook whistled over the wall.
"Any last words of advice?" asked Rek, dragging his sword free from its scabbard.
Drass grinned, drawing snugger.
"Live," he said.
More grappling irons rattled over the walls, jerking taut instantly and biting into the stone as hundreds of hands applied pressure below. Frantically, the defenders lashed razor-edged blades at the vine ropes until Drass bellowed at the men to stop.
"Wait until they're climbing," he shouted. "Don't kill ropes, kill men."
Servitar, a student of war since he was 13, watched the progress of the siege towers with detached fascination. The obvious idea was to get as many men on the walls as possible by using ropes and ladders, then to pull in the towers. The carnage below among the men pulling the tower ropes was horrific, as Bowman and his archers peppered them with shafts. But more always rushed in to fill the places of the dead and dying. On the walls, despite the frenzied slashing of ropes, the sheer numbers of hooks and throwers had enabled the first Nadir warriors to gain the battlements. Hogan, with 5,000 men on Musif, Wall 2, was sorely tempted to forget his orders and race to the aid of Wall 1. But he was a professional soldier, reared on obedience, and he stood his ground. Chobadai waited at the bottom of the rope as the tribesmen slowly climbed above him. A body hurtled by him to splinter on the jagged rocks, and blood splashed his lacquered leather breastplate. He grinned, recognizing the twisted features of Nistzan, the race runner. "He had it coming to him," he said to the man beside him. "Now, if he'd been able to run as fast as he fell, I wouldn't have lost so much money." Above them, the climbing men had stopped now, as the Drenai defenders forced the attackers back towards the ramparts. Chobadai looked up at the man ahead of him. "How long are you going to hang there, Nakrash?" he called. The man twisted his body and looked down. "It's these green-step dung-eaters," he shouted. "They couldn't gain a foothold in a cowpat." Chobadai laughed happily, stepping away from the rope to see how the other climbers were moving. All along the wall it was the same. The climbing had stopped, the sounds of battle echoing down from above. As bodies crashed to the rocks around him, he dived back into the lee of the wall. "We'll be down here all day," he said. "The Khan should have sent the wolf's head in first. These greens were useless at Golgothir, and they're even worse here." His companion grinned and shrugged. "Line's moving again," he said. Chobadai grasped the knotted rope and pulled himself up beneath Nakrash. He had a good feeling about today. Maybe he could win the horses Ulrich had promised to the warrior who would cut down the old greybeard everyone was talking about. Deathwalker! A pot-bellied old man without a shield. "Chobadai," called Nakrash, "you don't die today, hey? Not while you still owe me on that foot race." "Did you see Nestzan fall?" Chobadai shouted back. "Like an arrow! You should have seen him swinging his arms, as if he wanted to push the ground away from him. I'll be watching you. Don't die, do you hear me? You watch yourself. I'll pay you with Deathwalker's horses." As the men climbed higher, more tribesmen filled the rope beneath him. Chobadai glanced down. "Hey, you!" he called. "Not a lice-ridden green, are you?" "From the smell, you must be wolf's head," replied the climber, grinning. Nakrash scaled the battlements, dragging his sword clear and then turning to pull Chobadai alongside him. The attackers had forced a wedge through the Drenai line, and still neither Chobadai nor Nakrash could join the action. "Move away! Make room!" called the man behind them. "You wait there, goat breath," said Chobadai. "I'll just ask the round eyes to help you over. Hey, Nakrash, stretch those long legs of yours and tell me where Deathwalker is." Nakrash pointed to the right. "I think you will soon get a chance at those horses. He looks closer than before." Chobadai leapt lightly to the ramparts, straining to see the old man in action. "Those greens are just stepping up and asking for his axe, the fools." But no one heard him above the clamor. The thick wedge of men ahead of them was thinning fast, and Nakrash leapt into a gap and slashed open the throat of a Drenai soldier who was trying desperately to free his sword from a Nadir belly. Chobadai was soon beside him, hacking and cutting at the tall, round-eyed southerners. Battle lust swept over him, as it had during 10 years of warfare under Ulrich's banner. He had been a youngster when the first battle began, tending his father's goats on the granite steps far to the north. Ulrich had been a war leader for only a few years at that time. He had subdued the Long Monkey tribe and offered their men the chance to ride with his forces under their own banner. They had refused and died to a man. Chobadai remembered that day. Ulrich had personally tied their chieftain to 2 horses and ordered him torn apart. 800 men had been beheaded and their armor handed over to youngsters like Chobadai. On the next raid he had taken part in the first charge. Ulrich's brother, Gatsun, had praised him highly and given him a shield of stretched cowhide edged with brass. He had lost it in a knucklebone game the same night, but he still remembered the gift with affection. Poor Gatsun. Ulrich had him executed the following year for trying to lead a rebellion. Tsubuda had ridden against him and been among the loudest to cheer as his head fell. Now, with 7 wives and 40 horses, Tsubuda was, by any reckoning, a rich man, and still to see 30. Surely the gods loved him.
A spear grazed his shoulder, his sword snaked out, half-severing the arm. Oh, how the gods loved him! He blocked a slashing cut with his shield. Nakrash came to his rescue, disemboweling the attacker, who fell screaming to the ground, to vanish beneath the feet of the warriors pushing from behind. To his right the Nadir line gave way, and he was pushed back as Nakrash took a spear in the side. Tsubadai's blade slashed the air, taking the lancer high in the neck. Blood spurted, and the man fell back. Tsubadai glanced at Nakrash, lying at his feet, writhing, his hands grasping the slippery lance shaft. Leaning down, he pulled his friend clear of the action. There was nothing more he could do, for Nakrash was dying. It was a shame, and put a pall on the day for the little tribesman. Nakrash had been a good companion for the last 2 years. Looking up, he saw a black garbed figure with a white beard cleaving his way forward, a terrible axe of silver steel in his blood-splashed hands. Tsubadai forgot about Nakrash in an instant. All he could see were Ulrich's horses. He pushed forward to meet the axeman, watching his movements, his technique. He moved well for one so old, thought Tsubadai, as the old man blocked a murderous cut and backhanded his axe across the face of a tribesman who was hurled screaming over the battlements. Tsubadai leapt forward, aiming a straight thrust for the old man's belly. From then on, it seemed to him that the scene was taking place underwater. The white-bearded warrior turned his blue eyes on Tsubadai, and a chill of terror seeped into his blood. The axe seemed to float against his sword blade, sweeping the thrust aside. Then the blade reversed and, with an agonizing lack of speed, clove through Tsubadai's chest. His body slammed back into the ramparts and slid down to rest beside Nakrash. Looking down, he saw bright blood, replaced by dark arterial gore. He pushed his hand into the gash, wincing as a broken rib twisted under his fist. "Tsubadai!" said Nakrash softly. Somehow the sound carried to him. He hunched his body over his friend, resting his head on his chest.
"I hear you, Nakrash. You almost had the horses. Very close. Damn good, that old man, eh?" said Tsubadai.
The noise of the battle receded. Tsubadai realized it had been replaced by a roaring in his ears, like the sea gathering shingle. He remembered the gift Gatsun had given him, and the way he had spat in Ulrich's eye on the day of his execution. Tsubadai grinned. He had liked Gatsun. He wished he hadn't cheered so loudly. He wished... Dras hacked at a rope and turned to face a Nadir warrior who was scrambling over the wall. Batting aside a sword thrust, he split the man's skull, then stepped over the body and tackled a second warrior, gutting him with a backhand slash. Age vanished from him now. He was where he was always meant to be, at the heart of a savage battle. Behind him, Rek and Servitar fought as a pair, the slim albino's slender rapier and Rek's heavy longsword cutting and slashing. Dras was joined now by several Draenei warriors, and they cleared their section of the wall. Along the wall on both sides, similar moves were being repeated as the 5,000 warriors held. The Nadir could feel it too, as slowly the Draenei inched them back. The tribesmen fought with renewed determination, cutting and killing with savage skill. They had only to hold on until the siege tower ledges touched the walls, then thousands more of their comrades could swarm in to reinforce them, and they were but a few yards away. Drust glanced behind. Bowman and his archers were 50 paces back, sheltering behind small fires, which had been hastily lit. Dras raised his arm and waved at Hogun, who ordered a trumpet sounded. Along the wall, several hundred men pulled back from the fighting to gather up wax-sealed clay pots and hurl them at the advancing towers. Pottery smashed against wooden frames, splashing dark liquid to stain the wood. Gilad, with sword in one hand and clay pot in the other, parried a thrust from a swarthy axeman, crashed his sword into the other's face and threw his globe. He just had time to see it shatter in the open doorway at the top of the tower, where Nadir warriors massed, before two more invaders pressed forward to tackle him.
The first he gutted with a stabbing thrust, only to find his sword trapped in the depths of the dying man's belly. The second attacker screamed and slashed at Gilad, who released his grip on his sword hilt and leapt backwards. Instantly another Draenei warrior intercepted the Nadir, blocked his attack, and all but beheaded him with a reverse stroke. Gilad tore his sword free of the Nadir corpse and smiled his thanks to Bregan.
"Not bad for a farmer!"
yelled Gilad, forcing his way back into the battle and slicing through the guard of a bearded warrior carrying an iron-pitted club.
"Now, bowmen!" shouted Druss.
The outlaw's notched arrows, whose tips were partially covered by oil-soaked cloth, and held them over the flames of the fires. Once burning, they fired them over the battlements to thud into the siege tower walls. Flames sprang up instantly, and black smoke, dense and suffocating, was whipped upwards by the morning breeze. One flaming arrow flashed through the open doorway of the tower where Gilad's globe of oil had struck, to pierce the leg of a Nadir warrior whose clothes were oil-drenched. Within seconds the man was a writhing, screaming human torch, blundering into his comrades and setting them ablaze. More clay pots sailed through the air to feed the flames on the 20 towers, and the terrible stench of burning flesh was swept over the walls by the breeze. With the smoke burning his eyes, Serbitar moved among the Nadir, his sword weaving an eldritch spell. Effortlessly he slew, a killing machine of deadly, awesome power. A tribesman reared up behind him, knife raised, but Serbitar twisted and opened the man's throat in one smooth motion.
"Thank you, brother,"
he pulsed to Abadak on wall two. Rek, while lacking Serbitar's grace and lethal speed, used his sword to no less effect, gripping it two-handed to bludgeon his way to victory beside Druss. A hurled knife glanced from his breastplate, slicing the skin over his bicep. He cursed and ignored the pain, as he ignored other minor injuries received that day. The gashed thigh and the ribs bruised by a Nadir javelin, which had been turned aside by his breastplate and mail shirt. Five Nadir burst through the defences and raced on towards the defenceless stretcher-bearers. Bowman skewered the first from 40 paces, and Kaiser the second, then Bar Britann raced to intercept them with two of his men. The battle was brief and fierce, the blood from Nadir corpses staining the earth. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, a change was coming over the battle. Fewer tribesmen were gaining the walls, for their comrades had been forced back to the battlements, and there was little room to gain purchase. The Nadir now fought not to conquer, but to survive. The tide of war, fickle at best, had turned, and they had become the defenders. But the Nadir were grim men and brave, for they neither cried out nor sought to surrender, but stood their ground and died fighting. One by one they fell, until the last of the warriors was swept from the battlements to lie broken on the rocks below. Silently now the Nadir army retired from the field, stopping out of bowshot to slump to the ground and stare back at the Druss with dull, unremitting hatred. Black plumes of smoke rose from the smouldering towers, and the stink of death filled their nostrils. Rek leaned on the battlements and rubbed his face with a bloodied hand. Druss walked forward, wiping Snaga clean with a piece of torn cloth. Blood flecked the iron grey of the old man's beard, and he smiled at the new earl.
"You took my advice then, laddie."
"Only just," said Rek. "Still, we didn't do too badly today."
"This was just a sortie. The real test will come tomorrow."
Druss was wrong. Three times more the Nadir attacked that day, before dusk sent them back to their campfires, dejected and temporarily defeated. On the battlements, weary men slumped to the bloody ground, tossing aside helmets and shields. Stretcher-bearers carried wounded men from the scene, while the corpses were left to lie for the time being, their needs no longer being urgent. Three teams were detailed to check the bodies of Nadir warriors. The dead were hurled from the battlements, the living dispatched with speed, and their bodies pitched to the plain below. Druss rubbed his tired eyes. His shoulder burned with fatigue, his knee was swollen, and his limbs felt leaden. But he had come through the day better than he had hoped. He glanced around. Some men lay sprawled asleep on the stone. Others merely sat with their backs to the walls, eyes glazed and minds wandering. There was little conversation. Further along the wall, the young earl was talking to the albino. They had both fought well, and the albino seemed fresh. Only the blood which spattered his white cloak and breastplate gave evidence of his day's work. Regnag, though, seemed tired enough for both. His face, grey with exhaustion, looked older, the lines more deeply carved. Dust, blood, and sweat merged together on his features, and a rough bandage on his forearm was beginning to drip blood to the stones.
"You'll do, laddie," said Druss softly.
"Druss, old horse, how are you feeling?" Bowman asked.
"I have had better days,"
snarled the old man, lurching upright and gritting his teeth against the pain from his knee. The young archer almost made the mistake of offering Druss an arm to lean on, but checked himself in time. "Come and see Kaiser," he said.
"About the last thing I need now is a woman. I'll get some sleep," answered Druss. "Just here will be fine."
With his back to the wall, he slid gently to the ground, keeping his injured knee straight. Bowman turned and walked back to the mess hall, where he found Kaiser and explained the problem. After a short argument, she gathered some linen while Bowman sought a jug of water, and in the gathering twilight they walked back to the battlements. Druss was asleep, but he awoke as they approached him. The girl was a beauty, no doubt about that. Her hair was auburn, but gold-tinted in the moonlight, matching the tawny flecks in her eyes. She stirred his blood, as few women had the power to do now. But there was something else about her, something unattainable. She crouched down by him, her slender fingers probing gently at the swollen knee. Druss grunted as she dug more deeply. Then she removed his boot and rolled up the trouser leg. The knee was discolored and puffy, the veins in the calf below swollen and tender. "Lie back," she told him. Moving alongside him, left hand curled around his thigh, she lifted the leg and held his ankle in her right hand. Slowly she flexed the joint. "There is water on the knee," she said, as she set down his leg and began to massage the joint. Druss closed his eyes. The sharpness of the pain receded to a dull ache. The minutes passed, and he dozed. She woke him with a light slap on the calf, and he found his knee was tightly bandaged. "What other problems do you have?" she asked coolly.
"None,"
he said. "Don't lie to me, old man. Your life depends on it."
"My shoulder burns," he admitted.
"You can walk now. Come with me to the hospital, and I will ease the pain." She gestured to Bowman, who leaned forward and helped the axeman to his feet. The knee felt good, better than it had in weeks.
"You have real skill, woman," he said. "Real skill."
"I know. Walk slowly. It will feel a little sore by the time we get there." In a side room at the hospital, she told him to remove his clothes. Bowman smiled and leaned back against the door with arms folded across his chest.
"All of them?" asked Druss.
"Yes. Are you shy?"
"Not if you're not," said Druss, slipping from his jerkin and shirt, then sitting on the bed to remove his trousers and boots. "Now what?" he asked.
Kaiser stood before him, examining him critically, running her hands over his broad shoulders and probing his muscles. "Stand up," she told him, "and turn round." He did so, and she scrutinized his back. "Move your right arm above your head, slowly." As the examination continued, Bowman watched the old warrior, marveling at the number of scars he carried.
Everywhere, front and back, some long and straight, others jagged, some stitched, others blotchy and overlapped. His legs, too, showed evidence of many light wounds. But by far the greatest number were in the front. Bowman smiled. "You have always faced your enemies, Druss," he thought.
Kaiser told the warrior to lie on the bed, face down, and began to manipulate the muscles of his back, easing out knots and pummeling crystals under the shoulder blades.
"Get me some oil," she asked Bowman without looking round.
He fetched liniment from the stores, then left the girl to her work. For over an hour she massaged the old man, until at last her own arms burned with fatigue. Drus had fallen asleep long since, and she covered him with a blanket and silently left the room. In the corridor outside she stood for a moment, listening to the cries of the wounded in the makeshift wards and watching the orderlies assisting the surgeons. The smell of death was strong here, and she made her way out into the night. The stars were bright, like frozen snowflakes on a velvet blanket, the moon a bright silver coin at the center. She shivered. Ahead of her, a tall man in black and silver armor strode towards the mess hall. It was Hogan. He saw her and waved, changed direction and came towards her. She cursed under her breath. She was tired and in no mood for male company.
"How is he?" asked Hogan. "Tough," she said. "I know that, Cursor. The whole world knows it. But how is he?"
"He's old, and he's tired, exhausted. And that's after only one day. Don't pin too many hopes on him. He has a knee which could collapse under him at any time, a bad back which will grow worse, and too many crystals in too many joints."
"You paint a pessimistic picture," said the general.
"I tell it as it is. It is a miracle that he's alive tonight. I cannot see how a man of his age, with the physical injuries he's carrying, could fight all day and survive."
"And he went where the fighting was thickest," said Hogan, "as he will do tomorrow."
"If you want him to survive, make sure he rests the day after."
"He will never stand for it," said Hogan.
"Yes, he will. He may get through tomorrow, and that I doubt. But by tomorrow night, he will hardly be able to move his arm. I will help him, but he will need to rest one day in three. And an hour before dawn tomorrow, I want a hot tub set up in his room here. I will massage him again before the battle begins."
"You're spending a lot of time over a man you described as old and tired, and whose deeds you mocked only a short time since."
"Don't be a fool, Hogan. I am spending this time with him because he is old and tired, and though I do not hold him in the same reverence as you, I can see that the men need him. Hundreds of little boys playing at soldiers to impress an old man who thrives on war."
"I will see that he rests after tomorrow," said Hogan.
"If he survives," Kaiser added grimly.
Chapter 21. By midnight the final toll for the first day's battle was known. 407 men were dead. 168 were wounded, and half of those would not fight again. The surgeons were still working, and the head count was being double-checked. Many Jedi warriors had fallen from the battlements during the fighting, and only a complete roll call would supply their numbers. Rek was horrified, though he tried not to show it during the meeting with Hogan and Orin in the study above the Great Hall. There were seven present at this meeting, Hogan and Orin representing the warriors, Bricklin for the townsfolk, Serbitar, Vintar, and Virai. Rek had managed to snatch 4 hours' sleep and felt fresher for it. The Albina had not slept at all, and seemed no different.
"These are grievous losses for one day's fighting," said Bricklin. "At that rate, we could not hold out for more than 2 weeks."
His greying hair was styled after the fashion of the Drenai court, swept back over his ears and tight curled at the nape of the neck. His face, though fleshy, was handsome, and he had a highly practiced charm. The man was a politician, and therefore not to be relied upon, thought Rek. Serbitar answered Bricklin.
"Statistics mean nothing on the first day," he said. "The wheat is being separated from the chaff."
"What does that mean, Prince of Dros Segril?" asked the burgher,
the question more sharp in the absence of his usual smile.
"No disrespect was intended to the dead," replied Serbitar. "It is merely a reality in war that the men with the least skill are those first to fall. Losses are always greater at the outset. The men fought well, but many of the dead lacked skill. That is why they are dead. The losses will diminish, but they will still be high."
Should we not concern ourselves with what is tolerable? Asked the burgher, turning to Rick. After all, if we should believe that the Nadir will breach the walls eventually, what is the point of continued resistance? Are lives worth nothing?
Are you suggesting surrender? Asked Virai.
No, my lady, replied Bricklin smoothly. That is for the warriors to decide, and I will back any decision they make. But I believe we must examine alternatives. 400 men died today, and they should be honored for their sacrifice. But what of tomorrow? And the day after? We must be careful that we do not put pride before reality.
What is he talking about? Virai asked Rek. I cannot understand any of it.
What are these alternatives you speak of? Said Rek. As I see it, there are only two. We fight and win, or we fight and lose.
These are the plans uppermost at this time, said Bricklin. But we must think of the future. Do we believe we can hold out here? If so, we must fight on by all means. But if not, then we must pursue an honourable peace, as other nations have done.
What is an honourable peace? Asked Hogan softly.
It is where enemies become friends and quarrels are forgotten. It is where we receive the Lord Ulrich into the city as an ally to Drennan, having first obtained from him the promise that no harm will come to the inhabitants. Ultimately, all wars are so concluded, as evidenced by the presence here of Serbitar, a Vagrian prince. 30 years ago we were at war with Vagria. Now we are friends. In 30 years' time we may have meetings like this with Nadir princes. We must establish perspectives here.
I take your point, said Rek, and it is a good one. You may think so, others may not, snapped Virai.
It is a good one, continued Rek smoothly. These meetings are no place for saber-rattling speeches. We must, as you say, examine realities. The first reality is this. We are well-trained, well-supplied, and we hold the mightiest fortress ever built. The second reality is that Magnus Woundweaver needs time to train and build an army to resist the Nadir, even if Delnog falls. There is no point in discussing surrender at this time, but we will bear it in mind for future meetings. Now, is there any other town business to discuss? For the hour is late, and we have kept you over long, my dear Bricklin.
No, my lord, I think we have concluded our business, answered the burgher.
Then may I thank you for your help, and your sage counsel, and bid you good night.
The burgher stood, bowed to Rek and Virai, and left the room. For several seconds they listened to his departing footsteps. Virai, flushed and angry, was about to speak, when Serbitar broke the silence.
That was well said, my lord Earl. He will be a thorn in our side.
He is a political animal, said Rek. He cares nothing for morality, honour, or pride.
But he has his place and his uses.
What of tomorrow, Serbitar?
The Nadir will begin with at least 3 hours of ballistae bombardments. Since they cannot advance their army while such an assault is in progress, I would suggest we retire all but 50 men to Musiv an hour before dawn. When the barrage ceases, we will move forward.
And what, said Orin, if they launch their second assault at dawn? They will be over the walls before our force can reach the battlements.
They do not plan such a move, said the albino simply.
Orin was unconvinced, but felt uncomfortable in the presence of Serbitar. Rek noted his concern.
Believe me, my friend, the 30 have powers beyond the ken of normal men. If he says it, then it is so.
We shall see, my lord, said Orin doubtfully.
How is Drass? Asked Virai. He looked quite exhausted when I saw him at dusk.
The woman Kaiser tended to him, said Hogan, and she says he will be well. He is resting at the hospital.
Rek wandered to the window, opened it, and breathed in the crisp night air. From here he could see far down into the valley, where the Nadir campfires blazed. His eyes rested on the Eldebar hospital, where lamps still burned.
Who would be a surgeon? He said.
At Eldebar, Kalvar Sin, waist wrapped in a bloody leather apron, moved like a sleepwalker. Fatigue bit deep into his bones as he moved from bed to bed, administering potions. The day had been a nightmare, more than a nightmare, for the bald, one-eyed surgeon. In 30 years he had seen death many times. He had watched men die who should have lived, and seen men survive wounds which should have slain them outright. And often his own very special skills had thwarted death where others could not even staunch the wound. But today had been the worst day of his life. 400 strong young men, this morning fit and in their prime, were now rotting meat. Scores of others had lost limbs or fingers. Those with major wounds had been transferred to Musiv. The dead had been carted back behind Wall 6 for burial beyond the gates. Around the weary surgeon, orderlies flung buckets of salted water to the bloody floor, brushing away the debris of pain. Galvar Sin walked silently into Druss's room and gazed down on the sleeping figure. By the bedside hung Snaga, the Silver Slayer. "How many more, you butcher?" said Galvar. The old man stirred, but did not wake.